found a supply and traded in my mask for a new one. Again, the Staff of Power was missing in action for a few months. There was always food in the kitchen, and guys used to bring in massive jugs of pretzels and other snacks from Costco. One day a bin of animal crackers appeared in the team room. Handful by handful, the crackers started to disappear. You'd see guys eating the crackers as they walked from the kitchen to their cages or out to the ranges. Soon enough, about halfway through the jug, we found another Polaroid picture. This time, the Staff of Power was jammed into the middle of the bin with animal crackers piled up around the shaft. To this day, I still can't eat animal crackers. I have no idea if Phil was the culprit. I know he was the one who found it. But to date, the Staff of Power is unaccounted for. Chapter 6. Maersk, Alabama. The only thing Phil loved more than a good prank was parachuting. As my team leader, Phil had a passion that drove our team to air operations, in particular high-altitude, high-opening, hey-ho, jumps. The technique offered the best and most stealthy way to infiltrate a target. During a hey-ho jump, you exit the aircraft, open your parachute a few seconds later, and fly your canopy to the landing zone. I got my free-fall qualification at Team 5, but it wasn't until I got to DevGru that I truly mastered the art of jumping. Let me be clear. At first, jumping out of an airplane scared me. There was something unnatural about walking to the edge of the ramp and jumping out. Not only did it scare me, I hated it at first. I was the guy sucking down oxygen on the ride up. After every jump, when I was back on the ground, I loved it. But the next morning, I'd sweat it all over again. By forcing myself to do it over and over, eventually it became easier. Just like in Buds, quitting wasn't an option, and jumping was a big part of our job, so it was something I learned to love. While I was with Delta on my 2005 deployment to Iraq, Phil successfully led a hey-ho jump in Afghanistan. We always trained for this type of mission, but I never thought I'd do one for real. Since I'd joined the command, I rotated between Iraq and Afghanistan, deployment after deployment. Things had fallen into a pattern of deployments, training, and standby. There were so many missions, they started to blur together. We were rapidly gaining combat experience with each deployment. The command as a whole continually refined its tactics and had become even more combat effective. In 2009, we finally got something different. I was on personal leave, waiting for a commercial flight back to Virginia Beach, when I saw the breaking news bulletin flash across the TV screen in the airport. The Maersk, Alabama, a cargo ship with 17,000 metric tons of cargo, was headed for Mombasa, Kenya, when Somali pirates attacked it in transit near the Horn of Africa. It was Wednesday, April 8, 2009. The pirates captured the Maersk, Alabama's captain, Richard Phillips, and fled with the captain in one of the ship's 18-foot covered lifeboats. They had 9 days of food rations. The USS Bainbridge, a destroyer, was shadowing the lifeboat, which was motoring about 30 miles off the Somali coast. Four pirates were on board, armed with AK-47s. Sitting in the airport, I wondered if we were going to get the call. Getting personal time off was a huge feat, since my squadron was on standby and could be called to deploy anywhere in the world within an hour's notice. Watching the TV at the airport, I could see the orange lifeboat bobbing in the surf. Nearby was the gray-hulled USS Bainbridge. I tried to stand close so I could hear the report over the noise of the airport. Nothing was going on when I'd left Virginia Beach a few days earlier, but now I had a feeling we'd be getting a call. As footage of the lifeboat popped up on screen again, my phone buzzed in my pocket. It was Phil. "You watching the news?" he said. "Yeah, just saw it," I said. "Where are you at?" At this point, I was the most senior member of my team besides my team leader. "I am at the airport," I said. "I'm literally waiting for my flight." "Okay, good," Phil said. "Get back as soon as you can." Instantly, I could feel my mind racing. The plane couldn't fly fast enough. This mission was a once-in-a-lifetime chance. I didn't want to miss it. Boarding a plane is frustrating enough when you're not in a rush. I watched as folks meandered to their seats or fussed with the overhead bins. I pleaded with them in my head to hurry. The sooner we took off, the faster I could get back to work. Plus, I knew once I was airborne, I'd be in a communications blackout. There was no way to contact me if they got the word to go. For all I knew, as the flight attendant sealed the doors to my plane, I was getting the recall notice telling me I had 1 hour to get to the command, and by the time we landed, the team would be gone. Putting my headphones in, I tried to zone out, but I couldn't. 5 steps from the gate after we landed in Virginia, I was on the phone. "Hey, what's up?" I said when Phil picked up. It was well after 8 at night since I'd come from the West Coast. "Still here," he said. "Come into work tomorrow early and we'll get you up to speed. Planning is underway, but we're waiting for D.C. to make a decision." The next morning, I was at work early. Phil met me in the squadron room. We sat down at the conference room table. "We've got one hostage," Phil said. "4 pirates. They want $2 million for him."
"Nothing like knowing exactly what you're worth," I said.
"I'd ask for more," Phil said. "A couple of million seems a bit light unless you ask my ex-wife."
"Where are they going?" I asked.
"They want to link up with their buddies and try and get Phillips to a camp or a mothership," Phil said. "So we've got to be ready to do a ship takedown or go over the beach and take out one of the camps."
We'd spent years preparing for either mission.
"We've already got a handful of guys on the Bainbridge," Phil said. "They were working in Africa and jumped in last night. Negotiations broke down Thursday."
"How long do we have before they make shore?" I asked.
"They don't want to make landfall where they are now because of some tribal issues," Phil said. "Their tribe is a little farther south, so they can't make landfall for another 2 days, so hopefully we have a timeline to work against."
I asked about the recall.
"No recall, but it's being discussed," Phil said.
"Why haven't we heard anything yet?" I said. "It doesn't make any sense that it takes this long to make a decision."
"Dude, it's Washington," he said. "Does anything make sense?"
A day later, we finally got a page recalling us. Most of us were already at the command. Our gear was packed and ready. About 20 hours later, the ramp of the C-17 cracked open and sunlight spilled into the cabin. I could feel the breeze on my face as I shielded my eyes from the bright East African sun. Minutes later, I saw the small parachute attached to a massive gray high-speed assault craft, HSAC, snap open and start to drag the boat out of the back of the plane. The boats were loaded with all the gear we needed. The plan was to drop them and the crews first, followed by the assault teams. Click, click, click. I could hear the boat on the metal rollers as it started toward the door, picking up speed before disappearing off the ramp. Moments later, a second parachute opened, and the gray blur of the second boat flew past as it shot out, followed by the boat crews.
"Yeah," I yelled as I watched the boats go.
Others around me cheered as the boat crews disappeared off the ramp. My heart was beating faster, more from excitement than anything else, as I waited for the thumbs up from my teammates on the ramp. They were watching to make sure the chutes on the boats opened. We were jumping over the horizon from the USS Bainbridge, so the pirates couldn't see us. The USS Boxer, an amphibious assault ship used to carry Marines into battle, was going to rendezvous with us, and we'd stage off of her deck. In the water below, the boat crews landed near the HSACs and started clearing off the parachutes. We had 30 minutes to wait before we jumped, which seemed like much longer. I was sitting near the front of the plane on one of the bench seats. On top of me was one of my squadron's communication specialists. He was wearing a tandem passenger harness strapped to the front of me. Hours before, he'd learned that not only was he going to Africa to help us with a hostage situation, but he was also going to jump into the Indian Ocean to do it. In order to get all needed personnel down to the USS Boxer, we had to jump 3 tandem passengers, including the communication specialists. These 3 non-SEALs were essential support personnel. During the flight over, I had a chance to sit down with the communications tech and brief him.
"You're mine," I said. "You ready for this?"
He was thin, with a short haircut and a bookish demeanor. He looked a little nervous when I started to go over the jump and what to expect.
"You ever jumped before?" I asked.
"No," he said.
When we got the 6-minute call, everyone stood up to do our last-minute checks.
I noticed the communication specialist looked pale. He hadn't said a word since the door opened the first time. At least my first jump was over Arizona. His was a real-world jump into the Indian Ocean.
"We're gonna be fine," I said.
He didn't look convinced. The ramp opened again. There were about 40 jumpers on the plane, and we lined up on the ramp.
"Stand by!"
the jump master yelled, giving us the signal that we had less than 30 seconds before the jump. I could feel the communication specialist's legs start to shake. It was practically vibrating as we got closer to the ramp.
"Hey, buddy, just relax," I said.
All I needed him to do was remember everything I had told him.
"Green light, go!"
the jump master pointed off the ramp. Up ahead, everyone started waddling to the ramp and diving off one by one. As we got closer to the ramp,
I could see the sky and water meet at the horizon.
I reached up and tapped my passenger on the shoulder twice and screamed over the wind into his ear.
"Hang!"
That was the signal to get into position. I wanted his toes hanging over the edge of the ramp, so when we dove out, I didn't rake his shins on the ramp. He froze. I could feel his feet try and dig into the ramp. I tapped him again and yelled,
"Hang!"
Again, he didn't move. We didn't have time to wait. I pushed him forward and we dove off the ramp. The drogue chute popped off my back. The small parachute helped stabilize us and controlled our speed during freefall. Just like during hundreds of other jumps, I went through my checks and pulled the handle and opened the main canopy. Suddenly all the airplane noise bled away and everything was perfectly quiet. The only sound was the chute snapping in the wind. Looking around, it was beautiful. The fresh air was a welcome relief from the C-17 cabin. The sky and water were the same crystal blue, and only a few wispy clouds were high above us. Scanning below me, I could see a maelstrom of parachutes all circling the four gray boats bobbing on the ocean below. It looked like a World War II dogfight as my teammates swooped around in circles avoiding one another and coming to rest in the ocean. The water was calm, with very small waves. Not far off, I could see the flat deck of the USS Boxer waiting for us. As we came in, I flared out the parachute and splashed down into the bathtub temperature water. Unhooking the communication specialist, I started to work my way out of the parachute harness. We weren't more than 20 yards from the boat. Sliding my flippers off my ankles where I'd taped them for the jump, I started to swim over to the communication specialist. Behind me, the chute started to slip below the surface as the reserve parachute filled with water, dragging it to the bottom. I swam up to the communication specialist as he paddled, in a life jacket, toward the ladder hanging off the boat.
"How was it, dude?" I said.
"That was crazy," he said. It was the first time I saw him smile since the ramp opened. Climbing aboard the HSAC, I found a place near the front while we waited to get a head count. Since the boats were only built for 12 people, it got crowded quickly. I climbed to the bow and let my feet dangle in the water. I let the current push my fins around.
"Hey, man, did you see any sharks?"
one teammate said to me as he climbed into the bow area.
"No,"
I said. I knew the waters around here were infested, but I hadn't noticed anything coming in.
"Dude, as I was coming in, I saw this massive shadow below,"
he said. I slid my fins closer to the boat. During our flight over, Phillips tried to escape, ratcheting up tensions. He made it into the water before being fished out at gunpoint. The pirates bound the captain's hands and threw a phone and American two-way radio into the ocean, thinking the captain was somehow taking orders from the ship. By now, the lifeboat was out of fuel and was adrift. Commander Frank Castellano, captain of the USS Bainbridge, persuaded the pirates to be towed by the destroyer and to allow the ship's rigid-hulled inflatable boat to deliver food and water. During one of the supply runs, the fourth pirate, Abdul Walimusi, asked for medical attention for a cut hand. He was transferred to the Bainbridge for treatment. He'd been injured when Phillips attempted to escape.
After setting up on the USS Boxer on Saturday,
we sent a small team over to the USS Bainbridge. The rest of the squadron was told to hold tight. In the event that the lifeboat made landfall, we would be forced to attempt a rescue mission on shore. The team that went over to the Bainbridge was made up of an assault team, multiple snipers, and a small command element. The SEALs set up an overwatch position on the fantail of the Bainbridge. Snipers started a rotating watch as negotiations continued. We waited patiently for the situation to develop. On Sunday, we suddenly got word that Phillips was now on board the USS Bainbridge and safe. Soon all the guys were back, and I ran into my friend Gary. He was in the class ahead of me during BUDS. Gary came to Green Team a few years after me. He started his SEAL career driving mini-subs. It was funny to think of him folding his 6-foot-4-inch frame into the sub. He was awarded a Silver Star on the last deployment. He literally stitched up 5 guys trying to flank his element during a mission in Kandahar. Gary went over to the Bainbridge and was in charge of interrogating the captured pirate, Wally Musi. We shook hands.
"Dude, holy shit, give me some scoop," I said.
"We caught the last one when he popped his head up and smoke-checked all 3, Gary said. Gary told me he was tasked with talking to the injured pirate, Musi. Gary hoped the pirate could persuade his comrades to surrender. Gary started killing Musi with kindness when he got to the Bainbridge.
"Hey, man, want some ice cream?" he said. "How about a cold Coke?"
Musi and Gary struck up a quick friendship over food and comfort. Gary kept Musi out in the open so the other pirates could see him drinking Cokes and eating ice cream.
The pirates still on the lifeboat had to yell back and forth to negotiate.
"I can't hear," Gary told Musi. "Tell him to pull the rope in."
Musi agreed, and the line got shorter and shorter, the lifeboat inching closer to the Bainbridge. The seas were getting rough, and with no engine, the lifeboat was getting tossed around. As it got dark, Gary and his teammates pulled the lifeboat even closer. It was pitch black, and there was no way the pirates could tell they were being pulled closer to the USS Bainbridge. On the fantail, Gary and his teammates scanned the lifeboat. Infrared lasers that can only be seen through night vision goggles danced over the skin of the boat. One of the pirates always sat on top of the covered area, keeping watch. Engaging him would be simple. They could also see one pirate through the window steering the boat, another relatively easy target. But the third pirate was always hidden, and they needed to take out all 3 at the same time. The only way to take the shots and ensure Phillips' safety was to get the third pirate to expose himself. Finally, after hours of waiting, on Sunday night the third pirate's head and shoulders emerged from the rear hatch of the lifeboat. That was all the snipers needed.
The orders stated, "Only act if Phillips's life was in imminent danger."
With tensions already high and fearing for Phillips's safety, my teammates opened fire. In seconds, all 3 pirates crumbled under the barrage. After the last of the sniper shots rang out, the team on the fantail heard one unmistakable crack from a pirate's AK-47.
The single shot echoed over the water, and my teammates were immediately deflated.
The stakes were high. Washington was getting frequent updates, and they were watching drone feeds of the lifeboat. The commanding officer of DEVGRU and our squadron commander were both on the USS Boxer. Fearing the worst, and not knowing if Phillips was dead or wounded, 2 snipers near the tow line jumped up and started to slither down the rope to the boat. There was no time to waste. Balancing on top of the tow line, which bobbed inches above the dark waves, they reached the boat in minutes. Armed with only pistols, they boarded the lifeboat and swung inside the enclosure. There was a single opening into the raft, making them an easy target for even a wounded pirate. Entering the life raft, they quickly and methodically re-engaged each pirate, making sure there was no more threat. They found Phillips tied up in the corner, unhurt. The USS Bainbridge's rigid hull inflatable boat carrying a handful of SEALs was shadowing the lifeboat. When they heard the shots, the boat raced in, and the SEALs pulled Phillips off the lifeboat. Back on the Bainbridge, before the last shot rang out, Gary grabbed Musi and slammed him onto the deck.
"You're going to jail," he said. "Your buddies are dead. You're useless to me now."
With his hands cuffed and a hood pulled over his head, Musi was led away. Gary met Phillips at the fantail. The captain was confused and disoriented as he climbed on board the Bainbridge.
"Why did you guys have to do that?" Phillips said.
He was suffering from a minor case of Stockholm Syndrome, and in the shock of the shootings, he didn't understand what had just happened and why. Phillips underwent a medical exam and was found to be in relatively good condition. It didn't take long before the Stockholm syndrome wore off. He was thankful for what my teammates had done.
He called his family and was flown to the USS Boxer before heading home to Vermont.
The rest of us spent a few more days on the USS Boxer waiting for follow-on orders before moving ashore and then flying home. It felt good to finally save a life instead of just taking guys out. It was cool to do something outside of Iraq and Afghanistan. I was happy to do something different. But the downside was, we got a glimpse of the Washington machine and just how slow the decision-making could be. We were ready to launch on this days before we actually got the call. But the Captain Phillips mission renewed our capabilities and put us on Washington's radar for other high-profile missions. Chapter 7. The Long War. My legs ached and my lungs burned as I raced up the mountain. It was summer 2009, and we were about 8,000 feet up in the central Afghan mountains, 2 hours south of Kabul. After the Phillips rescue, we returned home, trained for several months, and then deployed on schedule to Afghanistan. I could see the infrared laser from the aerial drone tracking the movement of 8 fighters who ran out of the target compound when we arrived.
Our team tore off after them as soon as the helicopter's ramp hit the ground.
Alpha team has visual on squirters, was all I heard Phil say over the radio. The fighters were headed for a ridgeline 300 meters north of the compound. We were trying to cut them off while the rest of the troop took down the compound. As we closed on their position, I looked back to see Phil and the rest of the team close behind. It was our first mission on this deployment, and we were still getting used to the altitude. Seeing the rest of the team moving into position, I snapped back around and shouldered my rifle. The enemy fighters were setting up a fighting position roughly 150 yards away. I could barely keep my laser steady after the 500-meter run in all of my gear, but I managed to lock on to the fighter with a PKM machine gun. Squeezing off multiple rounds, I watched him fall. By then, my teammates arrived and opened fire, dropping 2 more fighters before the rest disappeared over the ridgeline and out of sight. Leaving their dead, the remaining fighters raced down the backside of the ridge. "We have 5 hot spots moving to the north toward several compounds," I heard the drone pilot say in my radio. I could see the laser from the drone moving down the backside of the hill. Phil gave the team a nod, and we were off on another dead sprint to close the distance. As we crested the top of the ridgeline, we slowed down, careful not to rush into a hasty ambush.
I saw 3 bodies lying there,
one with the machine gun and one with an RPG. We were lucky to take out their 2 biggest guns in the first seconds of the fight. The dead fighters were dressed in baggy shirts and pants and black cheetahs,
high-top, puma-like sneakers worn by Taliban fighters.
It was a running joke in the squadron that if you wore black cheetahs in Afghanistan, you were automatically suspect. I've never seen anyone but Taliban fighters in those sneakers. From the ridgeline, we could see the surviving fighters tearing down the backside of the hill. Phil snatched the RPG lying next to one of the dead fighters and fired it at the group as they ran off. The rocket landed nearby, and the shrapnel peppered the fighters as they ran. Dropping the launcher, he turned to me. Over the radio, we were getting calls about close air support, or CAS. An AC-130 gunship was circling above us.
"CAS is coming on station!" Phil literally screamed at me from 2 feet away.
The RPG had knocked out his hearing.
"I can hear you," I said. "Stop screaming."
"What?"
Phil said. For the rest of the night, I could hear Phil before I saw him. Every word out of his mouth came in a scream. We watched from the ridgeline as the AC-130's 20mm cannon pounded the fighters.
Sending the combat assault dog, which Phil had nicknamed the hair missile, ahead,
we spent the rest of the night chasing down the remaining fighters. All of them were either mortally wounded or dead. Phil and another assaulter chased a fighter into one of the compounds, while the rest of us started to clear a field of waist-deep grass. The AC-130 was reporting more hotspots. We launched the hair missile, and he locked onto the scent of a fighter about 50 feet to my right. I could hear the fighter start screaming as the dog attacked. Calling the dog off, the assaulters threw hand grenades into the ditch where the fighter waited to ambush us. As they moved up to clear the ditch, I started to move forward. Even under my night vision goggles, it was difficult to see. The grass was thick and hard to walk through. Behind me, I could hear intermittent gunfire as Phil and another assaulter were in a firefight with a barricaded shooter in one of the compounds. My gun was up, and I tried to use my laser to illuminate a path through the grass. I could see burnt patches ahead of me
where 20-millimeter shells had hit.
Every step was measured. I saw a dark shadow at my feet, underneath my night vision goggles. I lifted my foot to step on it, assuming it was a log or a branch, when I heard a man gasp. I jumped back and opened fire. It scared the shit out of me. Taking a second to confirm I didn't actually shit myself, I got my nerves under control. I moved up to search the body. He must have been dead before I got there. The weight of my foot on his chest forced the air out of his lungs. The body was singed from the 20-millimeter rounds. After a quick search, I found an AK-47 and a chest rack. Back in Jalalabad, we posed for some pictures after the mission. Phil, wearing a black Under Armour skull cap, had the RPG draped over his shoulder. The picture would be a reminder of the time he cut down the enemy with their own RPG, and blew out his hearing. It was a good night's work, and a great start to a lively deployment. That night, we killed more than 10 fighters and suffered no casualties. As usual, it was a combination of skill and luck. Without a doubt, the shooter in the ditch would have ambushed us, which proved the value of the combat assault dog. Since arriving at the unit, my life had been a series of highs from great operations, and then days of lows waiting for the next mission. If we weren't deployed, we were training to deploy. We'd alternate deployments between Iraq and Afghanistan. The pace was non-stop. It didn't matter if you were single or married with kids. Our whole world was focused on our work. It was our number one priority. It isn't smart for me to get too much into families for security reasons, but it is also dishonest to make you think we didn't have them. We had wives, kids, girlfriends, ex-wives, and parents and siblings all vying for our time. We tried to be good fathers and spouses, but after years of fighting the war, it was hard to be present, even when we were at home. We lived with one eye on the news, waiting for the next Captain Phillips story. When we trained, we did it in a way that was as accurate as possible. We were too busy doing our normal deployment, training, and keeping the wheels on the bus at home to think of much else. For the most part, our families understood the lifestyle. When we're gone 8 to 10 months out of the year on training or deployment, they always ended up being the last priority. They wanted us home. They wanted us safe. They knew very little of what was really going on in our lives. They never experienced the satisfaction of knowing that every IED maker or Al-Qaeda fighter we killed made the world a little safer, or at least made life easier for the soldiers patrolling along the roads in Afghanistan. They might understand it in theory, but they were always left at home to worry. The families waited for the men in dress uniforms to arrive at their door and deliver the news that we weren't coming home. The SEAL community has lost a lot of great guys, and DevGru alone has lost more than its share. Those sacrifices have not been for nothing. The lessons we learned and the heroic actions of our brothers were not going to be in vain. We knew the risks on deployments and in training. We knew how to live with them, and we understood that we had to sacrifice to do this job. Our families, like my father, who hadn't wanted this lifestyle for me, didn't always understand. Just before my high school graduation in Alaska, I told my parents my plan to enlist. My parents weren't pleased. My mother didn't let me play with G.I. Joe or other military toys when I was younger because they were too violent. I still joke with my mother that had she let me play with action figures and get it out of my system, I might not have joined the military. Before graduation, I sat in the kitchen and talked on the phone with recruiters. At first, I think my parents thought it was a phase, but soon they realized how serious I was about joining the Navy. My father sat me down to talk about my plans and about college. "I just don't want you in the military," he he finally said. He wasn't a pacifist by any means, but he'd grown up during Vietnam, and he knew how war impacted people. A lot of his friends had been drafted and hadn't come back. He didn't want his son to ever go to war. But I didn't hear the concern in his voice, or the nervousness about his only son putting himself in harm's way. I just heard him tell me what I couldn't do. "I'm doing it," I said. "This is what I want." My father never raised his voice. Instead, he reasoned with me. "Hear me out," he said. "If you ever listen to anything I say, will you take one piece of advice from me? Try 1 year of college. If you don't like it, you don't have to go back." My dad knew that I hadn't seen much of the world growing up in a small village in Alaska. They were betting if they could talk me into going to school, I'd be exposed to so many new things that I wouldn't pursue my dreams of becoming a SEAL. I was accepted to a small college in Southern California. "Okay, Dad," I said. "1 year." 1 year turned into 4, and with my degree, I considered joining the Navy as an officer. I made friends with a former SEAL in school who advised me not to join as an officer. He told me I could always become an officer later, but the enlisted route meant more time as an operator and allowed me to stay in the fight. When I enlisted after college, my father had no objections. Like all of my teammates, I was driven to be a SEAL. And once I finished BUDS, I was driven to be the best SEAL I could be. I wasn't unique. There was a whole command of guys just like me.
But like me, they all struggled with balance.
We called it the speeding train.
It was hard to get on, and it was hard to get off.
But once you're there, you'd better hang on, because you're in for a ride. We really had 2 families. The guys at work, and then family and loved ones left at home. I came from a tight family in Alaska. I felt the same way about them as I did about my teammates, like Phil, Charlie, and Steve. For a lot of guys, keeping the balance between work and family life was fleeting. Many of my teammates suffered through bitter divorces. We missed weddings, funerals, and holidays. We couldn't tell the Navy no, but we could tell our families no. And we did. Often. It was difficult to get time away. Work was always the number one priority. It took everything out of you and gave back very little. The funny thing was, even when we were on leave before a deployment, I'd see guys at work. We came in to work on gear, work out, or just take care of last-minute issues before we deployed. The dirty secret of it all is that everyone, including me, loved it. We wanted to get the call every time, which meant everything else in the world took a back seat. I was on my 11th consecutive combat deployment in 2009. I had worked my way up from a new guy to being Phil's number 2. From 2001, the only break I had was green team, if you call that a break. That was 8 years straight of either going on missions or training for them. By now, I was smarter and more mature. As I moved up, new guys came in behind me. The new guys now had more combat experience. They were certainly better than I was when I arrived at green team. The command as a whole was better. We were primarily focused on Afghanistan. Even with operations in Iraq winding down, our pace never lagged. We all wanted to work, but all of the senior guys were starting to feel the miles. Steve had moved up. He was in charge of one of the other teams in our troop. Charlie was an instructor in Green Team. It was a summer deployment, which meant we were busy. The annual Taliban summer offensive was in full swing. During the winter, the fighting slowed because it was cold and miserable. When an American soldier went missing at the start of the summer, we dropped everything to find him. Private First Class Bo Bergdahl disappeared on June 30th, 2009. A Taliban group captured him and quickly moved him closer to the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan in hopes of getting him across. Our intelligence analysts tracked every lead after his disappearance, and we launched on several rescue attempts, but came up empty. It was a race to get him back before they smuggled him to Pakistan. The fear was that the group that captured him would eventually sell him to other groups, like the Hakini Network, a a terrorist group allied with the Taliban. Less than a month after he disappeared, the Taliban released a video showing Bergdahl, dressed in the baby blue long shirt and baggy pants of the region, sitting in front of a white wall. He was lean, with a long neck and a little scruff under his chin. In the video, he looked frightened. One evening, just after the first video appeared, we got word they might have a possible location for him. Intelligence says he was likely in this area south of Kabul today, our troop commander said, pointing at a map of central Afghanistan. We don't have much intel to go off of, but this is a priority. We were gathered up for a mission brief at the operations center. Steve and his team were there too. The entire troop was slated to go. The plan was to fly to the Y, which means landing just outside of RPG range and then moving into position. It wasn't as safe as patrolling in, but it wasn't as dangerous as flying to the X. It was the only way we could assault the target and clear it before the sun came up. It was already midnight, which meant we were running out of darkness, so we had to launch immediately. We've got 100% illumination tonight, so it will be bright as fuck out there, fellas, Phil said. Typically, we try not to operate when the moon is full. Our night vision works even better, but the high illumination means the enemy could see us too, cutting our advantage in half. Tactical patience is key. We typically like to wait and develop a target, and then hit it with the odds stacked in our favor. We weren't fighting second graders. The Taliban are good fighters, and we already knew the operation had the potential to get squirrely. Hey, guys, we are getting our hands forced a little here, the troop commander said. We need to accept a little more risk because of who we're going after. A cloud of dust covered me as I ran off the ramp of the CH-47 Chinook helicopter. We landed in an open field, and my team's job was to move west of the target while Steve and his team moved south, creating a loose L shape as we moved toward a cluster of compounds where we thought Bergdahl might be held. The target was an hour and a half helicopter ride from our base in Jalalabad. There was a house on the edge of the landing zone. Steve's team took a few steps off the ramp before fighters started spilling out of it. One of the Taliban fighters had a PKM machine gun. I could hear the automatic weapons fire over the rotor noise as I ran. Looking over my shoulder back at the helicopters, I saw the tracer rounds, like lasers, cut through the dust cloud and zip past the helicopter. I could just make out Steve's team diving for cover and instantly maneuvering on the enemy. Under effective machine gun fire, one of Steve's teammates pulled out his pirate gun, a small single-shot grenade launcher. In a one-in-a-million shot, he popped up between machine gun bursts and lobbed a grenade into the house, which landed perfectly inside the door. I heard a muffled explosion and saw smoke start pouring out of the door. The grenade suppressed the fire immediately, giving Steve and his team vital seconds to close on the house without taking any casualties. Stacking next to the door, they cleared the house and killed the remaining fighters. "We've got movers to the north and to the east," Phil said over the radio. With so much moonlight, I could see like it was daylight. If they could make us out with a naked eye from 100 meters away, using our night vision, we could see them at 300 meters. The field in front of us was perfectly flat, and I could see fighters with weapons slung on their backs racing away from the helicopters. A road ran from north to south across the field, past the compounds and out of the valley. I could just make out two guys on a pair of mopeds racing away. Phil spotted a group of four fighters running west away from the road toward a small house. "I've got me plus two," Phil said. "We'll take the guys to the west. You take the guys on the bikes." Steve's team cleared the target compound. There was no sign of Bergdahl, but we figured he had to be somewhere nearby. There were too many fighters here, and they were well armed. With me were two snipers from our reconnaissance unit called Recce, plus the EOD tech. Phil took the dog team and one assaulter. As we ran across the field, we practically stepped on top of a fighter hiding in the grass. I didn't see him at first. One of the snipers made him out and opened fire. As we moved forward, I noticed he was wearing cheetahs. Guilty. Moving forward again, I saw the fighter's mopeds parked just off the road. I picked up two heads popping up over a hay bale, which had to be 4 to 5 feet tall at least, and 10 or 15 feet wide. I've got a visual on two packs roughly 300 meters at 12 o'clock, I said. In military jargon, packs are people. The snipers saw them, too, when we stopped in the field and took a knee. We needed a quick plan. I'm gonna set up on the road and see if I can get a shot, one of the snipers said. He was one of the most experienced snipers at the command. In a previous deployment in Iraq, he had hunted down an Iraqi sniper who was shooting Marines. It took him weeks, but he eventually found the Iraqi sniper holed up in a house. He shot the Iraqi sniper through a missing brick in the wall. The road was to the left of the hay bale and had a little rise, giving him some high ground. I'll take the right flank, the EOD tech said. Okay, I said. I'll take the middle and try and get a hand grenade over the top of the hay bale. I didn't love this plan, but we didn't really have a choice. With our fields of fire and Phil's team to our right flank, we were limited on how we could maneuver to clear around behind the hay bale. I trusted the snipers to cover me as I moved up. It was about a 200-meter shot, not easy, but with their scopes and night vision, it was not difficult either. We quickly moved to our positions. Recce set. I was carrying a small, extendable ladder on my back. I dumped it in the grass and marked it with an infrared or IR chemical light. EOD set. Transferring my rifle to my left hand, I knelt down and took a grenade from my pouch. I slid the pin out and held it in my right hand. I took a deep breath and started to sprint toward the hay bale. I could only hear my breathing and the wind whipping by as I tried to close the distance before the fighters peeked over the top again. About halfway to the hay bale, I heard an AK-47 open fire off my right flank. Phil and his crew must have tracked down the enemy fighters. The sprint didn't take more than a few seconds, but in my mind everything slowed like a television replay. I was less than 100 feet from the hay bale when a head popped up. I was in the open, with no cover. I couldn't freeze. I had to get to the hay bale. I didn't have the best arm, so I knew I couldn't clear the hay bale with a throw from this distance. I had to keep closing. A split second later, several rounds from the snipers hit the fighter in the chest, sending him tumbling back like a rag doll. One of the rounds ignited the propellant on an RPG rocket strapped to the fighter's back. As he tumbled back behind the hay bale, I saw sparks and fire shoot out of his backpack. He looked like a giant sparkler. Sliding to a stop at the base of the hay bale, I tossed the grenade over the top and rolled away. I heard the crack of the explosion and turned to run. Under the cover of the sniper, I linked up with the EOD tech and the other sniper in the field. We maneuvered back to the hay bale while the second sniper covered us. Coming around the left side with our guns at the ready, we found one fighter on his back, the RPG still burning underneath him. There was no sign of the other fighter. As we began the search for the missing fighter, a message crackled across the radio. We've got a wounded eagle. We've got a wounded eagle. Request immediate medevac. One of the snipers with me was a medic and immediately started moving toward Phil's team. We still hadn't found the missing enemy fighter, so I pushed the thought of who might be wounded out of my mind, and the three of us continued to search. I helped the EOD tech gather up the fighters' guns and mopeds. The fighters had morphine kits and grenades. They were professionals, not some farmers who picked up AK-47s when the crops weren't in season. We never found Bergdahl on that deployment, and as of the summer of 2012, he was still a prisoner. But in my gut, I think he was there at some point. We probably missed him by a few hours, or maybe in the fight, they were able to escape. After things quieted down, the EOD tech set charges to blow the enemy's equipment. I'm ready, the EOD tech said. We moved to a safe distance, and he set off the charge, blowing the gear and the fighter's body to shreds. The charge gashed the hay bale, setting some of it on fire and leaving a black scorch mark on the rest. We never found the other fighter's body, but when we went back to make sure the gear was destroyed, we found three human hands. We guessed the fighter probably crawled into the hay bale and died. Before long, I heard the familiar sound of an inbound CH-47 Chinook. It sat down just long enough to hustle the patient on board before it was back in flight and moving fast toward the trauma hospital in Bagram,
a massive airfield north of Kabul.
Alpha 2, this is Alpha 1, Phil said over the radio. I was Alpha 2, Phil was Alpha 1. It was the first time I'd heard from Phil since we split off to chase the squirters. "Hey, man, take care of the guys for me," Phil said. The wounded eagle was Phil. He was sitting on the deck of the helicopter with his pant leg cut open. Blood soaked the deck and his uniform. He was feeling no pain thanks to a heavy dose of morphine. I found out later his team had been closing the distance on two heavily armed fighters. They sent the combat assault dog ahead. The fighters saw the dog and opened fire. Phil was hit, and the dog was killed. The bullet tore open Phil's lower leg. He almost bled out and died, but quick work by our two medics not only saved the leg,
but also his life.
"Hey, you got it, brother," I said. "Take care." Walking back to the landing zone to regroup with the troop, the jokes already started.
"Good job taking out Phil so you can be in charge," said one of my teammates. "We saw you shoot him in the leg and run over and grab his call sign patch."
Phil wasn't even at the hospital yet, and the shit-talking had already begun.
Chapter 8. Goat Trails.
I had to take a leak. Since boarding the helicopter 30 minutes before in Jalalabad for the ride to a combat outpost in Afghanistan's mountainous Kunar province, the pressure had been building. It was standard procedure for everybody to take a leak before you left, but it was such a short ride, I decided to hold it until we got there. It was 2 months after Phil got shot. He was home, recovering. We had about 3 weeks left on our deployment. I had been a team leader ever since Phil was medevaced. We were heading to a remote forward operating base, or FOB, in one of the most volatile regions of eastern Afghanistan. The FOB was going to be a staging area for an operation we were going to conduct high in the mountains. I could feel the CH-47 Chinook helicopter come to hover and start to descend. A few seconds after the tires hit, the ramp came down, and I dashed off the bird, walking under the massive rear engine, headed for a ditch about 20 yards from the landing zone. We landed about 50 meters outside the perimeter of the small firebase, so I felt pretty safe standing out in the open. I was joined by a few of my teammates, who also sought relief. It was pitch black, and no illumination. The mountains towering above me blocked any chance for light. Over my shoulder, the helicopter's blades beat the ground, creating a dust cloud. The roar of the CH-47's engines was deafening. Standing at the lip of the ditch, I admired the beauty of the steep mountains. Through the green glow of my night vision goggles, it actually appeared quite peaceful. Then my eyes caught the glow of something streaking across the sky. For a split second, I thought I was looking at a shooting star, until I realized it was heading right for me.
Whoom!
A rocket-propelled grenade slammed 10 feet off the tail ramp of the helicopter, showering my teammates with shrapnel. Before I could react, I saw tracer rounds and more rockets crash around us. I started to move toward a ditch on the other side of the landing zone. Everybody was stunned. In our minds, we were simply using this base as a jumping-off point for our mission. We didn't expect to make contact until we assaulted the actual compound a few hours later. I could hear the whine of the helicopter's engines change as they took off and flew out of the valley. As the second helicopter lifted off in a hurry, its rotor wash set off one of the trip flares that surrounded the perimeter of the small combat outpost we were planning to stage from. The flares, in theory, were set up to alert the base of an attack. But we were now exposed, illuminated by the flare, and in the open. We started to peel back in small teams away from the light as the fighters shifted fire toward the base. I tried to get my pants buttoned up while in a dead sprint. I could hear the thump of the first outgoing mortars and then the steady hammering of an American 50-caliber machine gun as the soldiers at the base reacted to the attack. Sliding into a ditch, we watched as the American heavy weapons started raking the ridgeline. It looked like a blooming onion at Outback Steakhouse. Guns stuck up on all sides of the base, made of HESCO barriers, large wire frames filled with sand. Once the flare died out and we had the cover of darkness again, we maneuvered our way back to the main gate and inside the protective wall of the outpost. When we got inside the gate, our medics started working on the wounded. No one was hurt badly, but shrapnel from the RPGs hit an Army Ranger, our interpreter, an Afghan soldier partnered with us, and our combat assault dog. The helicopters were loitering nearby, and when the fire stopped, they raced back into the valley to pick up the wounded.
Once all the wounded were loaded on the helicopters and safely on their way back to the hospital, the troop chief and team leaders met with the FOB's Army Company commander and first sergeant inside the command bunker.
Charlie and the rest of the troop waited in the outpost's weight room. Charlie had volunteered to come over for the last couple of months of the deployment and was running with my team. Since Phil had been wounded and I took over, we were a man short and needed an extra shooter. Charlie had just finished his time as a green team instructor.
"Heard you shot Phil to get this job," Charlie said when he got in country. "Is that how you get a team now? Better watch your six."
I had missed the big bully, and it was good to have him back. Once Phil left, the pranking around the camp stopped. I was confident my room was free from glitter bombs, but the mood was never as light as when Phil was prowling around. Most of all, we missed his experience. Much like a football team, we had the next-man-up mentality. We all knew how to do the job, but it was hard to argue against experience. Phil had a ton of it. The pace of operations made it hard to dwell on the past, but he was missed, for sure. Having Charlie back made up for some of it. Fresh off of instructor duties at Green Team, he was sharp, and on this operation, he was going to be vital. His experience and calm demeanor under fire were second to none. The operations center was small, and maps of the area hung on the wall above furniture made of plywood. Antennas stuck up out of the corner of the squat building. Sandbags made up the walls and roof, protection against RPGs and mortar rounds.
A radio sat in one corner, and two young Army specialists, or junior enlisted men, sat nearby, monitoring it.
I stood next to Steve and looked at the map.
"Sorry about the welcome party," the Army captain in charge of the outpost said. "We get it about once a week. You just happen to be at the right place at the right time."
Operating in Kunar was tough. I'd argue it was one of the toughest places to effectively target the enemy in the entire country. It was rare that we made the trip up to the province without getting into a fight. Located in the lower Hindu Kush, the mountains and narrow valleys with steep sides serve as formidable natural obstacles. The province has been a favored spot of insurgent groups for decades. Its impenetrable terrain, cave networks, and border with the semi-autonomous Pakistani Northwest Frontier Province provide significant advantages for militant groups. Known as Enemy Central or Indian Country, between January 2006 and March 2010, more than 65% of all insurgent incidents in the country occurred in Kunar. Native Taliban forces mingle with foreign Al-Qaeda fighters, while Mujahideen militias also operate in the region. On a table at the center of the room was a map of the area. We all huddled around it. The plan was to patrol deep into a valley to the south of the outpost and conduct a killer capture operation against a group of high-level Taliban who were having a meeting. We were coming up near the end of deployment, and this might be our last chance to hit such a juicy target. It had already been a solid deployment, despite Phil getting wounded and one of the dogs being killed. If we played our cards right, we were going to get a little payback. From our drones overflying the suspected compound, we observed roving patrols. Over the years, Steve and I had gotten pretty good at spotting what we called nefarious activity. Drone feeds by themselves don't look like much. On the screen, people look like small ants moving around. But to me and Steve, everything we could see on the feed was adding up. Most compounds don't have roving guards. Combine that with the location in Kunar and intelligence reports about the meeting, and it all added up to nefarious activity. We knew we were in for a fight. The plan was for my 8-man team to climb up the ridgeline and parallel the valley until we made our way past the target compound. We would set up a blocking position on the uphill side and contain the fighters in the valley if they tried to escape. They wouldn't expect us on the high ground, since the compound sat almost at the very top of a valley. The other two teams would patrol up the main road into the valley and try to flush the Taliban fighters out to where my team could ambush them. If the two teams made it all the way to the objective undetected, we would simply make our way down to the compound ourselves and help clear the target from all sides. Most times, the fighters wouldn't stay and fight when they saw us. Instead, they ran, trying to hide in the tree line or escape into neighboring valleys. To stop them, we set up a team on the high ground and let them wander into our kill zone. We'd cut them down easily before they had a chance to escape. The infiltration route was about 7 kilometers, not far, but only if you didn't account for the elevation change. My team would have to do the majority of the hard climbing that night because the route took us directly up the ridgeline. Knowing we had a very challenging climb ahead, I'd chosen to dump my bulletproof plates and only carry 3 extra magazines, a hand grenade, my radios, and a med kit. We all tried to go as light as we could. We had a saying, light is right. But when you ditch your bulletproof plates, you have to be willing to suffer the consequences. After our surprise at the landing zone, I was already second-guessing that decision. As we discussed the plan with the army captain, I could feel the soldiers' eyes on us. To the clean-cut soldiers, we probably looked like bikers or Vikings. Most of us had long hair by military standards. None of us had the same uniform on. Instead, we all had mismatched pants and shirts. We also had fancy 4-tube night vision goggles, thermal scopes, and suppressors on our rifles. We pretty much had all the latest in tactical fashion.
Each one of us was a professional who knew exactly what they needed for the job, and it was up to the individual operator to carry what he needed.
"Some of these guys aren't even wearing their plates," said one of the soldiers. The troop's recce team leader showed the captain the goat trail on the map. He was going to navigate the route for my team.
"You guys been up this goat trail?" he asked.
"I've seen it," the army captain said. "It is straight up. What kind of timeline are you on?"
"We want to hit it and be back before it gets light," the recce team leader said.
"There is no way you're going to make it," the army captain said. "The terrain is impossible, and there is no way you can do it in one cycle of darkness."
Since his unit lived in the valley, we couldn't really argue. It was their backyard. They'd seen the terrain in daylight.
"You guys ever been up there?"
the troop chief asked, pointing at the target compounds.
"The furthest we've ever been is here," he said, pointing to a spot not even halfway to where we wanted to go. "It took us 6 hours, and we made contact and got into a long firefight. We had to move back down out of the valley."
We spent a few more minutes talking about the plan. The troop chief looked at me, Steve, and the other team leaders.
"What do you guys think?"
This target was too good to pass up. Even with 3 fewer assaulters and no dog, we still had enough people to clear the objective. The drones watching the target reported no major movement, so we still had the element of surprise. We decided to scrap the plan of my team going up the goat trail, and we would all combine into a single patrol taking the road part of the way up the valley, then split off and loop around to the high ground and assault the target from above.
"Let's do it," I said,
when the troop chief looked to me. Steve also nodded yes.
"You guys are still going?" the captain said.
"Yeah,"
the troop chief said, finally.
"The attack on the base tonight might be a great cover for action," the army captain said. "Why don't we send out a patrol with you guys tagging along?"
He'd take about 20 soldiers out and patrol into a nearby village that was just down the valley to the south.
We'd follow along at the back of his patrol before peeling off and sneaking up into the target valley.
If people were watching, and they were most likely doing so, we'd hope they would take the bait and follow the main body of the patrol.
"You guys mind if we get some ammo before we go?" the troop chief said.
"Sure, I'll get it."
The captain started to organize a foot patrol while we went back to brief the guys waiting in the outpost's weight room. It had a few dumbbells, a weight bench or two, and a squat rack wedged into a room no bigger than a small home office. Sandbags protected the room, like the operations center, from mortar attacks. I replaced the few rounds I fired in my magazine and checked to make sure my team was ready. I could see Walt and Charlie loading their magazines as well. Walt was on Steve's team, and since arriving out of Green Team, he'd become tight with Steve and me. I'd heard about Walt when he was coming through Green Team. All of the East Coast SEALs seemed to know him, and they kept an eye on him as he worked his way up to the second deck. No taller than my armpit,
he had hair that was already shaggy, and a thick brown beard covered his face.
He was short, but his cocky swagger compensated for it. He had a healthy dose of little man syndrome and an inordinate amount of body hair. It seemed like the guy could grow a beard in days. Walt was supposed to start Green Team a year prior, but got in some trouble and had to delay his plans for an extra year. Walt and I got along almost immediately. He liked to shoot and loved guns as much as I did. One day on the range, I invited him out to the SHOT Show, a shooting, hunting,